Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Inspire Table podcast. I'm your host, Jordana Levine, and today we are back to our regular activity of featuring inspirational folk talking about inspirational things. Today I am joined by Genoa Van Keekham. Now, Genoa was one of those people that I kept seeing on all my friends' Instagram feeds, and I was like, who the hell is this dude? And then mutual friend of ours, Holly Azapati, brought him along to a Lunar Nights event, and I met him and I thought, this guy is cool. I'm going to get him on the podcast. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Genoa's work, he is a Vedic meditation teacher and speaker, and he's known for his refreshing approach to all things mind, body, and soul. Having followed a pathway through hospitality management, several uni degrees, alcohol sales, and a tendency towards skepticism, his words not mine, Genoa brings a raw and relevant perspective to his work. I thoroughly enjoyed having this conversation with Genoa. In this interview, Genoa and I discuss Vedic meditation specifically, which is the type of meditation that he teaches. We have a look at the stigma around not just meditation, but spirituality in general, especially when it comes to men and masculinity. We have a look at some of the benefits that he first experienced when he started learning meditation, and what he teaches to his students now. And we also have a deep dive into Genoa's daily practices, which is one of my favorite things to ask people about. And we talk about this idea of working less to achieve more, which I don't know about you guys, but that is something that I definitely want to sign up for when it comes to work. As always, if you enjoy this interview, take a screenshot of it on your phone and post it to Instagram stories. You can tag myself at Jordana Levine and tag Genoa at Genoa Van Keekham. About this is that I actually don't know much about you except that you're friends with a whole bunch of my friends, so you must be an A-OK dude. Why don't you tell me a little bit about who you are, both personally and professionally, however that comes out for you?
Who I am? Interesting. Yeah. So I originally was probably someone who, in terms of, you know, spirituality and meditation, was probably extremely against and so not open to anything that looked like that. So it's been a really interesting little evolution, I suppose, from how blinkered, I suppose, I was and set in my ways to sort of where I am now, but still sort of, I would say, pretty engaged in the world. So it's not like I've sort of become this airy-fairy woo-woo hippie now.
Yeah.
When I was, younger, sort of growing up, it was all, I was very much a, you know, a guy's guy. It was about footy, picking up girls, partying, whatever else. And my old man was always a bit of a hippie. And so I was exposed to a bit of this, I guess, feel this sort of interesting concept of there's something more going on as opposed to what we just are exposed to in terms of, you know, our, the social things of drinking and this and that, and there was, you know, something at a deeper level. So I was exposed to that, but I thought that was, I had an idea of spirituality being tied to religion or cults on it, sort of groups. And for me, that was extremely, extremely unattractive and uncool. And so I didn't give it the time of day. And anything that looked like that, I'd very strongly push that and him away. And so it was very much not part of my life, really, to be honest. And so, but there was also, which I now look back on and realize, were things that I experienced as a human being, which I thought were the norm. So also growing up, being the guy's guy, I thought it was also normal to be a guy and be anxious and nervous and almost to the point of wanting to be physically ill, you know, before a big game of sport or before even a date or things like that. And that was just normal, right? And so you had to push through that to be a man, you know, to push through that and show that you've got it sorted and got it together. And so that's sort of how I traveled through life. But also with this underlying inkling, I suppose, that there was, I wasn't operating to my full potential, you know, and I was just like, something, I don't know what that meant, but I felt like I could be giving more. And so, you know, I went through, did a pretty standard course at uni. It was a master's in commerce and studied a couple of degrees and spent a lot of time in hospitality, which was my big, big party phase. So that was, it was great fun and actually a really brilliant process for learning how to work with and deal with people in all sort of interesting scenarios. But that was a big part of my life. And then I moved to, so that was in Adelaide. So I actually grew up in Adelaide, a bit more regional-ish, I suppose, in a wine region, and then moved to Sydney and got stuck into the corporate world. So my first job was working, I was in a suit, stuck in an office working for an IT networking company. And, you know, the money was great. You know, I got to wear the fancy suit and blah, blah, blah. All my mates were in corporate and finance, so it kind of fitted. But it didn't feel quite right. And it was a bit of luck that, and, you know, I kept in touch with a guy who employed me years ago in hospitality, and he actually had launched an alcohol company which was looking to expand nationally. And then I sort of left the corporate world to work for him, which involved me basically working from home. And he was just like, here are the brands, grow them in New South Wales. So I spent the next few years doing that. I've been with that business for 7 years. And then by quite funny, because a lot of people immediately now, because I'm actually right now in the process of evolving away from that job. So I've just resigned from that job to go into teaching full time, which is right now there's a lot going on juggling that handover, and it's a bit of a just, you know, jumping in the deep end. But a lot of people, when I would talk about meditation, that I'm actually a teacher, and then I'd talk about, yeah, I still actually work for an alcohol company as a sales manager, like they'd straight away question, well, how does that work? How can you drink and still teach meditation? It's you know, a lot of people fight that's a prime example of the stigma around meditation and spirituality, and, you know, yoga teachers must be vegan and all whatever this sort of stuff is. So it's quite interesting. But the funny thing was that one of my first clients through working for the alcohol company actually ended up becoming my friend and meditation teacher, and helped me on the path to then becoming a teacher. So it's quite interesting how that sort of played out. And if it wasn't for that, I mean, I'm sure the universe would have given me a kick into that direction in some way anyway.
Yeah. Well, that was a clear channel through to you, right? Like, that's such a kismet encounter, something like that. Because, like you said, the spirituality coming through your dad didn't quite give you the channel that you needed. But coming through someone who was exactly like you or interested in similar things to you was the perfect way to introduce you into that world.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Beautiful. Mm. So you did, so what did you do? You started doing a meditation course with
him?
Yeah,
so it was her. So her father owned the restaurant, and he was this really cool, like, he was a chef, but he was like, you know, pretty hardcore. It was just a cool lad. He was in his 60s, and we used to catch up for coffee and talk business and this and that. And then I knew she was there as well, and she had her own PR company, was uber successful, and her partner used to own a vodka label, and he was involved in sort of fashion brand and creative director. I was like, who are these people? They're cool, but they still drink and eat meat, but they seem to be operating at this higher level. And then the meditation came out, and they're like, oh, we meditate. And I was like, ah. Oh. And they're so just whatever about it. Like, yeah, we do it. And he was like, the dad, he said one day, he goes, I just wish I'd learnt this when I was younger. Mm. And that still stuck with me to this day, like 6 years later. Yeah. And that was the catalyst for me to go, I've got to look into this again. And then I started researching a bit into, you know, high performers around the world, and they all seem to have some kind of meditation involved in their routine, and lots of podcasts, and then a bit of the science behind it. And then, because me being naturally skeptical, and I still am to this day, having seen that science behind it, as well as the experience of seeing someone who was still real and seeing the benefits, was sort of what got me across the line to finally learn. That was just over 5 years ago that I actually learnt the technique, which is a Vedic meditation technique. Which
yeah, is beautiful. Okay, cool. I do want to dive into Vedic meditation specifically, but before we get there, what do you think? I mean, I think with a lot of spiritual teachings, and I always feel kind of icky saying that word, but there is the lack of people crossing that bridge, inverted commas, is because there's been such a kind of stigma around it for so long. What do you think part of that stigma is? Where do you think that came from? Why are people so adverse to something that seems to be enriching people's lives?
So it's part of it comes from, because I mean, with meditation or yoga, which meditation is a part of in its holistic sense, you in its, I guess in ancient times, a lot of these practices were aligned to a monastic style of life, right? And that was fine. But the way of living and the amount of stimulus we're exposed to back then is also extremely different to now.
Yeah.
And so there was that natural connection, and that's what a lot of these techniques were created from and aligned with different sort of religions or, you know, some people might look at prayer as their form of meditation or, you know, looking to a higher power. And so that naturally, that connection was there. And so we move through to a time now where that stuff is almost seen as a bit weird and woo-woo and would not allow you to be engaged as much in the things that we enjoy. So whether it's going out and being social and drinking, and it almost might put you in the category of a sort of a separated group, which is, and naturally as human beings, we like to be a part of, you know, the things we enjoy and seen as cool and whatever else. So aligning with something that is a bit unknown and seen as a bit weird isn't necessarily that attractive to us. And so naturally, where a lot of these techniques have stemmed through this ancient knowledge and through these monastic practices, that's where that comes from.
Yeah.
And so but the great thing about where we are now is that we've got this ancient, you know, techniques, and now finally we are having the Western science. Well, it's been actually, you know, over five decades with the research now going into the impacts of different, again, the word spiritual. I use that term loosely, even to, you know, define what that even means to people.
Yeah.
You know, practices that actually have a profound impact on our brain and nervous systems and our experience of life. And so what we need to do now is shift, it's about educating, really.
Yeah.
And shift that stigma that, yes, you can still, you know, practice a technique that has some loose associations with ancient knowledge and still be very much involved and engaged and relevant in the world as it is now, which is what we want to be.
Well, I think the whole idea is that we need to be able to integrate those ancient teachings into the modern day life, because we need it now more than ever. Because like you said, you know, we're hyper-stimulated now, and there's a lot more things that are stressing us out and keeping us away or disconnected from self.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think it's so brilliant that no offense here, Genoa, at all, but normal people like you can bring it into the mainstream, you know, because there has been such a divide for so long. I always feel like, you know, I tend to say to people, oh, you know, it's really common now. Everyone's doing yoga and everyone's meditating and green smoothies aren't that weird anymore. But I still think that we are living in this like bubble, I guess, of the eastern suburbs of Sydney or Australia at least. And it's not catching on to the greater community just yet, but it's not that far away. Do you kind of feel that as well?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Now, I mean, I speak to that's a big part of how and why I carry myself in the way I do. So I'm very open and honest about the fact that you might see me out having a drink and partying and having a good time, and there's no separation between this fake facade of this purist meditation guy, and then what I'm really doing in the back end. And so slowly but and everyone has been exposed to meditation in a way. Everyone's like, oh, and there's something intrinsically attractive and charming about this, something, this weird kind of thing that seems to be really helping people. And so everyone has kind of heard about it and is almost like, oh, maybe I should try it. Or you'd be surprised how many people have actually have dabbled in some kind of form of meditation. I think we're finally getting to a point where the manifestations of a nervous system that is, you know, under too much pressure are looking like, you know, severe anxiety or negative thought patterns or, you know, lacking in creativity. And so people are finally coming to a point where it's like, all right, what I, you know, having doing exercise and eating, you know, my meat and free veg isn't cutting it anymore. What else is there? And so it's definitely on this path to where I think everyone will be, you know, give us 10 years, it'll be a staple. It'll be, and that's what I try to work towards is, you know, I always say, you know, I want to be able to say to someone, yeah, you know, I'm having a coffee, going for a beer, meditating, you know, in the same sentence, I'm going to go to the gym. So if it's not some, you sort of whisper under your breath or you leave that little bit out and sort of normalize it. So it's definitely on the way up.
Beautiful. So let's talk then about some of the impacts that you noticed when you first started meditating that took you from, oh, hey, there's something in this to, I want to share this with other people. I want to teach this. So what kind of benefits did you start to notice when you first, sat down to practice meditation?
So it was interesting. So the technique that I learned and that I teach is slightly different to most of the other techniques that tend to fall under the mindfulness banner. So this technique is more of it's a laundering process. So removing or allowing the body to release the buildup of stress and fatigue in our system. So at first, my experience was a bit of an emotional detox, I suppose. So actually, for me, it was fatigue. So I spent the first little period of like, all I've been doing is sitting here with my eyes closed, whispering this little mantra sound in my head, and I'm feeling this shift throughout my body. I'm like, what is going on here? And so I was like, that's pretty, you know, pretty high impact right there. And then after some time of allowing the body to remove that, things started shifting in how I operated. So, for example, things like anxiety now are not even a thing for me. You know, if I feel a little bit of that sort of tickle in the stomach and that sort of tightness of the chest, now I almost have the ability now to feel it and almost smile at it, knowing that the fact that I am in a position that is maybe, you know, deemed by me out of my abilities means I'm in the realm of living and expansion and growing. And so that's huge for me, and probably one of the biggest, still to this day, the biggest takeouts for me, which is based around my awareness. So consciousness, awareness is my awareness of how I operate. So what I mean by that is I would be in a social situation and someone would be carrying themselves in a certain way. They'd be, you know, saying something or doing something or pressuring people to drink, whatever it is. And I'd be like, oh, how's that person? You know, it'd really trigger me. And I was like, it's just, how can they be carrying themselves that way? And I'd be like, why does this annoy me so much? I'm like, because that was me. It was almost like a bit of a slap in the face to go, I was that person who had to have everyone else around me drinking as well, or else I'd feel awkward. Or if I was in a conversation with someone and my drink was almost empty, I'd be like, all right, where's my next drink coming from? And I'd almost disengage from the conversation or things like that, or had a bit of a temper, or if people didn't align with my way of thinking, I was very dismissive. And so the biggest, if we want to shift how we operate as a human being, one of the first key pieces of that is awareness. We only know what we know, and if we don't realize these things, we find it really hard to shift. So one of the biggest pieces for me was having that awareness and almost a bit of a buffer between just reacting off the bat to now being able to respond and go, oh, hang on a minute. I still do it sometimes. I still act like a dick because I'm still a human being, but it's a lot less, and I'm a lot more able to go, oh, whoops, there I go, and maybe, you know, have the ability to not judge myself for being an asshole and try and shift for next time, maybe question why it was that I did that thing or acted in that way. Yes, there were some of the key, and a bit of compassion for other people as well. I was pretty quick to judge and not very very good at allowing other people's opinion. I mean, I'd listen to them, but if they didn't agree with what I was thinking, it wasn't really, I'd find a way to squash that. And so even my parents, I was like, so do you think I've changed?
Can you please validate me?
Because often we say to people, because when we meditate, what happens after a while is you becomes the new normal. So at first you feel some shifts going on, and then you normalize that experience. You're like, oh, it stopped working. And so I remember at one stage, so a great way to validate that often is to actually ask people close to you and say, what do you think? And so I asked my parents. My dad is like, oh, mate, he goes, if I told you something or said something that didn't align with your ways, it wasn't a pretty response. And mum saw the change in me so much to the point where she flew to Sydney just to learn to meditate. She's like, if you can do it, I'm doing this. Like, so it's
that's incredible.
Yeah. That was a big sort of moment. She stuck to it. Good on her, because she's like, wow. My little brother learned. He wasn't really that into it either. So he's, and people close to me are naturally seeing, wow, you've shifted.
Yeah.
But
you're still the same person.
Yeah. I'm still very much me, just a better version of me, I suppose.
I think self-awareness is one of the biggest game changers in people. When people can observe and have awareness of who they are and how they interact in the world, it makes for a much nicer person to be around, but also better connection with other people, don't you think?
Oh, and that's the true, that connection piece is something that's one of the biggest underlying things as humans we're all looking for, really, is that connection and having awareness of how we operate and having, you know, compassion, empathy towards how other people operate is going to allow for that at a greater level.
Yeah.
That's another big piece of that, yeah.
So tell me then, it's one thing to experience the benefits and, you know, get your family involved and kind of see the improvement in yourself, but at what point were you like, hang on, I think I want to make this my career?
So, you know, I've been meditating for about three and a bit years, and there's something in the back of mind that was like, oh, is there something in this? As in moving forward, and I was always attracted to my role being working for an alcohol company as a state manager was fine, but there was no real – I didn't feel like I was having a real impact in a positive way on people's lives. There was – and when I would talk to people and, you know, have a real juicy, deep conversation and feel like I may have had an impact, the feeling afterwards was amazing, you know, and I thought about – studying psychology, because my dad was also a counsellor, so there was something in that sort of I liked, and it was a bit of a sliding doors moment where I was actually looking to launch my own distillery, and I had a business plan, the business partners ready to go, and it was because I wanted to do something else, something that was mine and something of higher impact, and because alcohol and that industry is what I knew, that's what I was heading towards. And then it was my boss, absolute legend, he goes, are you sure this is what you want to do? And he's like, just have a think about this for a minute. And so I held off, and in that little 2-week period where I held off, I saw this thing come up on Instagram from my teacher and friend who was offering to become a meditation teacher, offering an 18-month sort of course. And I was like, and that just stood out to me. I was like, okay, so what is it in this? And I was looking around at other teachers, and I was like, to be honest, had I have not by chance become friends with Jack and learn from her, I wouldn't have learnt meditation. And I was looking around at most other teachers out there, and I was like, to be honest, none of them I attracted to either, and would probably not have gone that step and learned. And I was like, well, this technique is profound. How do I get more people like me? I looked at my mates and said, how would I get them to meditate? I'm like, well, maybe having someone like me meditating and being honest about it and still being out and having a good time and, you know, seeing those little subtle shifts in how I operate and how I experience life, maybe I could encourage more people to meditate and just bring it more into the norm.
Yeah,
and beautiful. So, I was like, and out of the blue, I was like, fuck it, I'm doing it. And I just sort of just jumped in it, and it's the best thing I've done. So, yeah, I've been teaching for about a year and a half. And so that was a sort of the shift that got me across to then decide, all right, maybe I become a teacher.
Yeah, beautiful. Hey, I want to ask you, and maybe this is a weird parallel that I'm making and it's not true, so tell me or not. First of all, the Jack that you speak of, is this Jack from The Broad Place?
Yeah, Jack
okay.
Lewis.
Okay, so aside from Jack Lewis, I feel like in the Vedic meditation space, at least in Sydney, it's very male-dominated. in terms of teachers. Do you, have you noticed that, or is that just me?
It is slightly, having said that, in the last three groups that have gone through to become teachers, like I was in a group, there was 12 or 13 of us. I was the only male.
Okay.
In the next group, there was only females. Mm. And the third group, again, there was only one male in a group of eight or so.
Okay, interesting.
So, yeah, I definitely think there are a lot of females out there teaching as well.
I wonder, though, in that observation that I made, do you feel like, and you'd probably have a greater sense of this now that you've been teaching, do you feel like the teachings of the Vedic tradition are more appealing to men because of perhaps the consistency and regularity of it? Like, there's quite a few boundaries and parameters that are set within the practice.
I suppose, I mean, looking back now, most of the big name teachers throughout, when it was becoming bigger throughout Australia and the US, a lot of those leaders were male. Mm. So I think that there's becoming a bit of a shift in that. So yeah, I think traditionally there was a lot more male teachers and male personalities as the ones that everyone saw aligned to these practices. I mean, and the idea is that there is a little bit of structure around the technique, but really, if anything, this probably technique is designed to be one of the most flexible techniques that you can use. So, I mean, does that attract males more with that more structure and maybe?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It was a curiosity, not so much a statement. I just, I guess as a female in the, again, inverted commas, spiritual space, you know, I see a lot of women coming through a lot of the work that I do and a lot of the work that my female friends are doing. And the space for the masculinity to be held in this space, you know, isn't as predominant. So when I see men turning to things more and more like meditation, it seems like an easier, or not easier, but like a more welcoming transition for them. And I feel like from what I've observed, and maybe it's just the people around me, that Vedic meditation seems to be an inviting path in for them, perhaps. I don't know.
Mm. Well, I guess it's because it's a lot more aligned to, there's a big combination between the ancient knowledge and Western science.
Mm.
And that, you know, seeing a lot of, you know, there's a lot of sports people now and performers and people that we respect, you know, and for a lot of, and practicing this style of meditation, and it's not too woo-woo. And so, you know, particularly as men, and that whole piece around masculinity is another interesting thing that I think also our understanding of what it means to be a man is also shifting. Mm-hmm. And that means that maybe incorporating a technique like this is actually okay, and it's actually going to help us, you know, perform better. And so I think that's also a piece that we're seeing more men practice this, and so other men who'll be like, oh, maybe this isn't just a weird woo-woo-y, you know, female yoga spirituality thing.
Mm.
This is, you know, I often talk about as a performance technique. So that also could be a reason why it's sort of becoming a bit more attractive for men to slowly come over.
Yeah. We need to get it into the NRL, I think. Side note.
Yes.
Yes. So tell me, this Vedic practice that you teach, I did a Vedic meditation course years ago now, and, you know, it was 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon, and I stuck to it for a few months, and then I found that really annoying having to do that, and I abandoned it. So tell me, what are the benefits of the consistency of those 20 minutes in the morning and the afternoon?
Right. So the way we sort of look at it is this is helping the body to remove stress and fatigue that we store in our systems, right? So throughout our lives, every single thing we experience almost leaves like an imprint or is stored in our bodies as chemical memories in the cells of our bodies and energetically. And so all this storage, I'll just use the word stress as the term for that, the storage of these stresses put pressure on our nervous system. And so over time, this becomes so built up to the point where our bodies are experiencing symptoms of too much stress and fatigue on our bodies. So symptoms of this are things like, you know, anxiety or depression, negative thought patterns, insomnia, you know, temper, irritability, lack of creativity, you know, learning, problems with memory and learning. And so it's coming to a point where I think it was something on the lines of, you know, even in one day, right, the amount of stimulus we're exposed to now, I believe, is equivalent to what we'd experience almost in a whole lifetime, like 200 to 300 years ago. And that's a lot. And so how does our body release and repair and recover from everything we experience? You know, everything from, you know, you wake up in the morning, you have your coffee, you're a little bit hungover because you had too many drinks the night before, and then you got a deadline, you see your boss, you get cut off in traffic, you're late for work, you get a parking fine, you drop your phone, you have a fight with your partner. And then there's the 60,000 thoughts that go on top of that. And that's all recycling and piling on in our systems. And so we go to bed at night, and that is when our body is able to rest and repair. And so the amount of rest and repair, I suppose, we get from going to sleep now isn't enough as to what we're putting into our systems and exposed to the amount of stimulus we're dealing with. So it's a bit of we're developing a lot of debt here. And so what this technique is about is about giving our bodies the opportunity to release more of that. So this technique, the Vedic based technique, is about using that mantra to de-excite the nervous system, which when this happens, the body is designed to release what it no longer needs, i.e. it's allowed to start resting and repairing and, I guess, laundering the stress, tension, and fatigue that we've piled up in our system. So, and then we go back into the day again the next day and pile more in again. And if so this practice isn't about, you know, I meditate for a week or just when I need it. This is about stabilizing the nervous system. So we do it day by day by day. So we are slowly releasing the built-up stress and fatigue from the past 30, 40, 50 years of our lives, plus increasing our adaptation energy. So that's our ability to deal with life and things without piling on more stress. So stress is not a thing. It's a perception of this thing. And so over time, and this is based on a mixture of, you know, our genetics, a bit of trauma, social conditioning, beliefs from our parents, and now we look out into the world in a certain way. You have two different people look out to the same situation, and one sees it as stressful, one sees it as an opportunity. And that's because of what the other, they're both experienced throughout their lives. So by doing this daily practice, we are removing the barriers to the expansion of our mind and our intellectual ability, and also removing the things that are manifesting into these undesirable experiences of, you know, anxiety and negative thoughts and all the rest. But it needs to be done consistently, because then we stop and we pile in more of the next few days. And so it's doing two things, that it's releasing the old, but also decreasing the amount of perceived stress. So things no longer seem quite as overwhelming or out of reach, or, you know, we tend to spend a lot of our time in looking over the past of why this happened and if only this had happened and blah blah, and then because of that our future's looking like this, you know, if this doesn't happen I'm gonna feel like this or blah blah blah. And so all this suffering comes from looking at the past, or, you know, speculating on the future. And so by having a daily practice, we are teaching our bodies to come back into the present moment. So meditation also cultivates a level of present moment awareness, which is another key piece in terms of what meditation is part of as well. So there's so much in it in terms of having this as just a daily practice. So for me, it's a non-negotiable now. I'll wake up in the morning, I'll brush my teeth and have my little routine and meditate. Like, I wouldn't leave the house without brushing my teeth. I wouldn't leave the house without meditating. You know, that's, if we believe that much in exercising and eating well, and if we believe in the brain, then we should be doing some kind of practice to help us with our brains and nervous systems, which is what meditation is now, pretty profoundly impactful for.
Yeah, that's such a good analogy, you know, like being so conscious of the cleanliness of your teeth, but being so conscious of the cleanliness of your mind.
Yeah, right? It's literally like the gym for your mind, like going, you know, giving your brain a good clean and exercising daily.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about your daily routine. We were talking about it before we started recording, but you said that you have a practice that you like to, I guess for lack of a better word, commit to every day. Can you run us through that? I'm fascinated by people's morning practices.
Yeah, it's interesting. So there's morning practice, but then I also have like daily and weekly the way I do things. So
tell us all about it.
Yes. So I look at our lives, like, you know, building a house. So, and we have all these, you know, ideal experiences we want to have. So for me, I love having experiencing creativity and abundance and freedom and connection and these sort of style things. And I'm like, okay, so how do I cultivate that in my life? And so our brain and nervous system and the source of our thoughts and whatnot is the foundation, right? That is like the key piece. So that's your meditation practice, which is the foundation, which is just always there. And then you look at experiences or activities that can allow you to have more of those experiences. So the building and the, you know, the wood and the walls of the house are things like, okay, so I know that I want to increase my creativity and things like that, so I am getting guitar and singing lessons, and I'll make sure that at least, you know, even if it's 15 minutes a day, I am doing an activity that allows me to have that experience. You know, then I also know that I want to expand and expand my knowledge and learn and grow, and so, and have a bit of me time, and that is my reading. So, you know, in the morning I'll have a bit of me time before I start my day. I'll have a coffee and read read a book. You know, then there's also, you know, that connection and abundance. And so that involves me having a bit of soul time, which might be having a bottle of wine with a friend. And, you know, making sure that if you look back at your week, I look at, all right, I know these are the activities that do this for me. Am I doing them regularly? Because it's so common for us to go, you know, I want to experience all this, and this. And it's like, well, are you actually doing the things that are going to help you along that way? And it's a cross training of all sorts of things. It's going to be different for everyone. So my morning is, I love to get up before sunrise because the energy of being up before sunrise is amazing. And so for me, it's around that sunrise wake up time where it's still beautiful and calm. And then I'll get up, I'll literally wash my face. I'll scrape my tongue with the copper tongue scraper, which once you start, you'll never ever stop. And then I'll go to the toilet.
It's gross, isn't it? What comes off your tongue? Yeah.
That scraping your tongue's gross. I said, you know what's gross is allowing that to stay.
Leaving it there.
Someone, totally. Then, you know, swallowing it, they're like, oh, fair point. So I'll scrape my tongue, then go back and meditate. So a big part of creating a fail-safe, creating a habit is, you know, you do your cue, your trigger, your behavior, and then your reward. So for me, it's morning, wake up. I won't even meditate, even if I'm not supposed to, in the morning because I'm so set in that routine now. I'll do it and I'll go back to bed, meditate. Then I'll get up, have a shower and go for a walk and read my book and have a coffee. And that's like my morning routine. So that's the ideal scenario. And then I'll get back and then I'll do a little bit of work. So I'll work on whatever it is I'm doing. And then my guitar's always sitting there. You know, when you feel yourself, you start not being able to concentrate and it's a bit, you know, you like start looking around and you get that urge to, now I'm learning to put my phone away. So I'll put it in my room so I don't get, you see a little Instagram thing come up or you get down the rabbit warren of social media and emails you really don't need to be answering to, but you kind of feel like it feels good to show that you're responsive and all that sort of stuff. And so I spend time where I'm now breaking it down to go, right, 25 to 30 minutes of attention on one project, and then I'll stop and then I'll strum the guitar for a few minutes and then blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, I'm done now. And then I'll come back and do another little block of 25 or 30 minutes. And you'll find those blocks will actually increase to 40 or an hour without meaning to. And so that's my rough morning activity. From about 10 till 3, I like to have as my meeting random projects time. So I'm a bit of, I like a bit of consistency, but also like a bit of, let's see what happens. So between 10 and 3 is my random meetings or a coffee catch up or whatever else comes into the day, or a bit of chore work or, you know, appointments. And then from and then in the afternoon, that's when I come back and it's like, that's the ideal time to do some exercise. So, you know, between sort of 3 to 6 or 7 for me is that kind of 3:30-itis, a bit of, you know, lack of motivation, energy. So that's the time when I'll do things that, like, I'll go to the gym because I know I'll be sort of feeling a bit sluggish, you know, so I'll go to the gym. Then I'll come back and maybe play some more guitar. And then I'll go and start looking for, you know, what I'm going to cook for dinner that night. And so that's my rough ideal, you know, is that sort of 3 till about 7 time is where I bring in those activities that I know help, whether it's like playing guitar or trying to draw again or practice my singing or catching up with a friend for a wine or for dinner or, you know, getting on the phone to mum or whatever that is. So that is my rough kind of daily thing.
I love it. I love finding this like happy medium between consistency and fluidity, because I think for so, and it's different for everybody, but I think for a lot of people, it feels like, you know, if I've set aside the time to do this, I have to stick with it. And, you know, like, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, going to play the guitar for 20 minutes in between when I'm meant to be working in a 3-hour block is going to decrease my productivity. When it's like, you know what? It's probably going to help your productivity.
Yep.
To walk away from it. So I love that you have that self-awareness of that, because I think that's what keeps people stuck for so long. I'm pretty much the same. Like, I'll work between the hours of maybe 7 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon because I know they're my productive hours. But I can't sit there for that block of time. I have to get up and do stuff, whether it's as something as mundane as doing the laundry or going for a walk or, you know, designing something on the computer, because that's sort of like my, you know, creativity or whatever it is. That's my guitar. I know that that's going to give me more productivity than sitting there and pushing through trying to write words that aren't coming up naturally.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm big under – I love the concept of – sounds interesting. And I used to struggle with this, is do less and achieve more. And so I remember I used to also talk to, when I was back more in corporate and evolving away into sort of this job and whatever, I'd speak to people and they'd be like, oh, how's work? And I was like, yeah, and I was at the office at 7 and, you know, it's pretty full on and stressful. I, you know, was left at like 6 or, you know, left at like 7 o'clock at night. I'm like, oh, it's solid days. I'm like, oh, how was your day? And I was like, yeah, you know, I read in the morning, had a coffee. You know, I worked, then I finished work about 5, went to the beach, and I'm like, oh, is that, what are you doing? Like, and it was almost like a badge of honor that we were hustling, and I was like, well, I used to, I mean, sometimes, don't get me wrong, there is requirements for you to do the hard yards, and I get that, but also I found myself prior to this, I was similar. I'd be at work at 7 or 8 to be seen. Was I more productive? Maybe not. And I'd hang a little bit later again to be seen because I was hustling and, you know, doing the right thing and working. And so it was sort of also a bit of a thing of how we operate. So it was, it's been an interesting shift around actually. Well, it's probably a better thing to be seen as working a little bit less and being more, you know, productive. And giving yourself that time, you know, whether it's that 5 minutes to go for a walk or literally do a chore or banking or even, you know, playing guitar, and actually increase your productivity. And if we can do less and achieve more,
then why wouldn't we?
And it took me a while to even get that.
I get it.
And now I'm proud to say, yeah, actually, you know, the other day I worked, you know, 4 or 5 hours and then had, you know, time to do this, this, and this. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Not that I'm lazy.
No, totally. I get it. I'm also from a corporate background, and I think that it really drums into you that, yeah, the more time you spend at your desk and the busier you are, then the better you are at your job. Like, I remember some of the corporate jobs I was in, nobody took lunch. Like, you know, you'd eat lunch at your desk if you even had time to eat it at your desk. But I used to ask myself, like, what are we doing all day when I get to the end of the day and I haven't actually achieved much at all?
Yeah.
You know, and now that I work on my own clock and my own routine, some days I do feel really lazy, but I look at what I've achieved and I'm like, yeah, hell yeah. What does it matter how long it took me to do it? Mm. Yeah, it's just it's just flipping the lens a little bit, I think.
And then, you know, keeping those practices at a lay to be more productive and sharper and more focused those periods of time. So it's, you know, I find a lot of people, they'll sort of, you know, work for hours and hours and hours and they won't have much time for the other things. And all those other things might actually, other practices might actually help you be more productive and give you more time, which is a hard concept. You know what I mean? It's like, cause that's not our way of thinking. It's not logical in our sense of operating, is it? So it's a hard shift to also understand and even get our bosses and colleagues to understand that maybe by allowing the space for that, you will be more productive.
Yeah. I had a guest on the show a few episodes back, Denise Duffield Thomas. I don't know if you've heard of her. She does money mindset stuff.
Yes.
And her latest book is called Chillpreneur. And it's all around that. It's about doing less and achieving more and being able to chill and take time out for yourself makes you a more productive being. And it's just, it's so in line with what we're talking about. It's really good.
Brilliant concept.
So, Genoa, if people want to learn more about Vedic meditation, can you tell us a little bit about how your teachings around it work, like what the process is of learning the art of Vedic meditation?
Cool. So the first step is to come along or log into a information talk. So I find it really important for people to really understand the technique and also listen and engage with me, because a lot of the problem with meditation is people have logged in, have tried. Everyone thinks meditation is just meditation. Well, no, not everyone. A lot of people think it's meditation. So they're like, oh, yeah, I've tried an app, or I've tried this guided thing. I can't stop my mind, or
I'm not good at it.
Yeah, I'm not good at it. I can't meditate. There's no way of controlling my thoughts. I'm like, well, me neither, but that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
And that comes from education. So the first piece is to actually have an understanding of what this technique is all about. So I do online talks, you can log in from anywhere. And if that doesn't work for you, I now offer a 20-minute one-on-one phone chat. So I will actually explain the technique, how it's different to, you know, the mindfulness and guided apps and those sort of style of techniques, which are quite different to what I teach. They're more about calming you then and there.
Yeah.
While what I'm teaching is more about releasing the old, sort of more going to the root cause of what we're experiencing. And so I'd recommend the first step is to engage in an intro talk or get on a call and really get understanding of, oh, yeah. And then also by listening to me, you'll also see if you'll vibe with me.
It's important, right?
If you're like, oh, this guy's a bit too rough around the edges and he swore in between this, and I'm like, maybe that's not quite my vibe, that's fine. And then I can probably direct you to someone else, or if you're too shy to say that, you can look at other teachers. So that's one. The first piece is to get a proper understanding of me or the teacher you're looking at, and then the technique and how it's taught. So most of the courses that are taught in this way would go either in 3 or 4 consecutive sessions or days.
Yeah.
So I teach mine in 3 consecutive sessions. So the first session is I do them in one-on-one. So that's like where you receive the mantra, and that takes about an hour. I take you through some sequencing, and I give you your first experience of meditating by yourself, and then we'll talk about it. And then the next, you go back and you meditate by yourself as your homework, and then you come back the following day, and that, either if it's in a private, it's just you one-on-one, or if it's in a group session, it could be you and 2 people, it could be you and 10 people. We all come together and then we meditate together, and I'll start weaving in information and knowledge as we go along, and pretty much make sure you are meditating to get the best results. And then you go away again the next night, meditate by yourself, and then come back the following day. And those sessions go from anywhere between 90 minutes to 2 hours. And then I'll talk a bit more about stress and what that means. And I'll talk about releasing stress. And I was like, what does that even mean? So I explain that in more detail. And then from there, once you've learnt with me, you then also have access to me moving forward. So, you know, a week down the track, you're like, oh, this isn't working, or I'm having a bit of release, or something's feeling a bit so-so, you can actually contact me and we can jump on a call or whatever it is and talk through it. And that is part of the course, not like an extra thing. And then also from that, There are every teacher's different. Some teachers do weekly sessions. Some teachers do fortnightly. Some monthly. Some don't do them at all. I do monthly group sessions, so that is anyone who has learnt the technique can come along. We meditate together and ask questions. And something about being in a group, that's that connection piece, being in a group with people who are in the same headspace as you, and asking questions and sharing, and I might talk about a topic of interest or some knowledge. That's also a nice reset that you can be part of once you've learned. So that's sort of the basics of how the courses and the best route to sort of go through the course and how they should be taught.
Yeah. And where are you based for people listening?
So I'm based in Bondi in Sydney,
okay.
But I'm pretty – the course itself, the course under this Vedic knowledge should always be taught in person.
Yeah.
There are some, you know, different versions of meditation which can be taught online, which are great, but this specific technique with this mantra should always be taught in person. So that is one part of it. Now, I also teach – like if there's enough people, I've got friends who are living in New York, and I said, look, if you can get, you know – 6 or 7 people keen, I'll fly to New York and teach you guys. Or if, you know, I'm from Adelaide, so there's people in Adelaide, if there's enough people, I'll fly and teach. So that's pretty, in that sense, I'm trying to be pretty fluid. And if there's, you know, people that want to learn, I'll head out. Plus, I'll probably, if not, I will probably be able to find a teacher in a regional area if that is a thing.
So if people want to find out more about you and your Vedic meditation courses, is there a website they could go to?
Yeah. So I'm mainly active on my website or Instagram at the moment. So the website is www.janoah.com.au. So Janoah is J-A-N-O-A-H.
You got your first name as a URL?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, because there's not many other Janoahs around there.
Yeah, love that.
So I got it. Yeah. And so my email good. Is like janoah@janoahvankeagram. And so, yeah, it's quite I was lucky that I got that.
Okay, cool. I'll share that in the show notes. What's your Instagram handle for everyone?
Yeah, it's at Janoah Van Keekem. So JanoahVanKeekem.
Okay. I'll put that in the show notes too. Thank you so much for chatting to me today. I really appreciate it. It's been a really interesting conversation and so nice to get to know you a little bit better as well.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks for having me on.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.